Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
Welcome to another episode of Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we're here to talk about our August 2020 book club pick, The Empress of Salt and Fortune by Ni Vo, which is an Asian-inspired fantasy novella. Rira, it's September as of this recording.
Yes, it is.
Our valley is literally on fire.
On fire.
It's like 109 where I am right now, which is...
Oh, what?
Yeah.
Like where I live, it was like 98 degrees.
Really? You live pretty close to me. You should definitely check your temperature.
No. I checked yesterday. It was on my phone.
Oh.
So like, I don't know why. It was cooler in my area, but I'm pretty sure it got hotter after I checked my phone.
Probably.
But I checked it at 2 p.m., which is the hottest time during the day. So I don't know.
I mean, you live like 20 minutes away from me. So I can't imagine your weather being that much different than mine. So maybe there's some weather magic in your area, just like in the book that we read.
Well, if there was weather magic, I would prefer it to be actual September weather. that's something that I still haven't gotten used to as someone who moved to LA from states that actually have fall weather.
I mean, for those of you who don't know, in Southern California, our peak summer heat runs from August all the way to like mid-October. So we have like an extended summer out here that really pisses all the East Coasters off.
It really messes with our rhythm, you know? Also, I have a closet full of coats that I'll never wear ever because there's no fall. There's no pre-snow type of season over here. So
I mean, yeah, this past year we actually had a winter, and we do have winter weather. We just haven't had it in a while, so who knows, you might be able to break out your coats this winter as well.
I don't know, our winter is just rain.
The bright side is we're now entering the last third of 2020, so hopefully this national or international nightmare will be over soon. Although we did say 2019 was trash and there was no way to go but up in 2020, and that was totally wrong.
The publishing industry, they've pretty much told their editors to not come into the office until January. So even they know that it's not going to be quote-unquote normal until at least then. I have my doubts. I don't think it's going to be normal until February or March next year.
Well, good thing we can do our podcast over the internet remotely, so we don't have to worry about social distancing and all that stuff getting in the way of this podcast. There ain't no stopping Books and Boba. We're going to keep this trend going.
Yeah, it's going to be 4 years at the end of this month.
I know. Wow. We're like...
We have not taken a hiatus. We've been pretty consistent with our episodes, at least 2 episodes per month, but usually like 3.
So this is our, 36th book club pick?
Is it? I don't know. I've lost track.
I'm pretty good at math, so 36. I'm pretty sure. Wow.
And that doesn't include any of the books that we've read for author interviews, which we've done quite a lot of.
That's true. Well, it's been a lot of fun doing this book club with you. And I guess congrats. Happy Books and Boba anniversary, Rira.
I would wish that towards the end of September, because literally our first episode released on the 28th.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we have some time.
We still got some time. But without further ado, let's get into what everyone's here for, which is our book club discussion of The Empress of Salt and Fortune. Rira, do you want to start us off with the book jacket description?
Yeah, sure. With the heart of an Atwood tale and the visuals of a classic Asian period drama, The Empress of Salt and Fortune is a tightly and lushly written narrative about empire, storytelling, and the anger of women. A young royal from the far north is sent south for a political marriage. Alone and sometimes reviled, she has only her servants on her side. This evocative debut chronicles her rise to power through the eyes of her handmaiden, at once feminist high fantasy and a thrilling indictment of monarchy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's... I remember when this book got a lot of buzz. The Library Journal said it was like the debut of the month. BuzzFeed said it was pretty much like the fantasy novel of spring 2020. So I was really excited about it. Plus Handmaiden's Tale and political drama. Yeah, sure. That sounds like something that I'm really interested in.
Yeah. I mean, my main thing is, I don't know if the Handmaiden's Tale comparison is that descriptive of what this story really is. Because to me, it definitely was a pro-woman story. But I don't really know if I got Handmaiden's Tale vibes from it, besides the fact that there's like a handmaiden in it.
You know, I actually got more of the Handmaiden, the Korean movie. I got more of that vibe because that movie is it's told in multiple perspectives, and the story is not what it seems like, and you kind of have to like piece together everyone's motives and how their plans and motives like fit together. So it kind of reminded me more of that movie.
Yeah.
Which is also based on a book. It's based on The Fingersmith by Sarah Waters, which I highly recommend. It's great.
Yeah.
It's also queer, which is, you know, this book is also very queer.
Yeah, it's a very queer-friendly story. There's a lot of different characters on all sides of the LGBTQ spectrum. And I guess we can start with just how the story is set up. So the story is told through, I guess... Would you call this second person narrative? Is that what this is, or
no? It's third person narrative.
Right.
Actually, it's third person, and then when it switches to flashbacks, when Rabbit is telling the story, that's first person.
Right. So, but basically, the main character or the I mean, they're not even protagonists, right? Like the, I guess, perspective character through the story. Like the main character is a monk, or in this world a cleric named Chi, who is coded as non-binary. They go by they them pronouns, and their magical talking bird companion, who is actually like a supercomputer, right? It's like they're like a bird that can remember and archive everything it sees and hears.
You know, I had to Google what a hoopoe was, because I like through context clues, I was like, okay, it's a bird, but I don't know what this bird looks like.
Yeah.
Looks like. So I had to Google what it was.
I mean, right off the bat, and we can talk about this later or now if we want, but this book is a novella, so it's really short. It's like 128 pages, I want to say, or it's less than 150 pages.
Oh, what? Okay, so I just checked how many pages it was on Kindle. It's 112 pages.
Okay, so even less.
Yeah.
And in those short amount of pages, it does a ton of world building. And I know this is something that you and I have thoughts about, but like, to me, I feel like it did a lot of world building through giving really sparse details and requiring the reader to kind of fill in the blanks. Like right off the bat, you have a talking bird, which it took me a while to figure out it was a bird. You have like supernatural elements in this world, like hungry ghosts. Yeah, and you have like implied magic in the world too. There's allusions to mages and weather magic, like we mentioned. So like right off the bat, it kind of throws you into this world that the reader has to figure out what's going on through context clues, totally independent of the actual narrative. Because I think even without the fantastical elements, I feel like the narrative does also stand alone on its own as like a story of political intrigue and rebellion.
Yeah. The scene is set up quite nicely. You do have, since the book is really short, you do have to catch a lot of details. If you read through it quickly, the book is done within a blink of an eye. So you really have to take your time digesting the story and really soak in the details. Or you have to do what I did, which is read the book twice. So, and I will say that during the second read, I realized that I missed a lot of details from the first read, because a lot of the times, like after each flashback, Rabbit tells Chi, "Do you understand?" And when I read it the second time, I was like, "Okay, no, I did not understand. I did not understand that." Like a lot of the objects that were present throughout the novel, I didn't really understand their importance as much, especially like the, what was one of the objects? The star charts and the box of black salt. Like it kind of flew over my head when I read it for the first time. Oh. So I was really grateful that I read it the second time and understood like who died and just like a lot of how Empress Inyo kind of smuggled information to the north and how she got, how she like usurped the throne. So I was really appreciative of like the small, subtle details.
Yeah, I was able to, I mean, the star maps, I was able to get that the first time around. The salt part, I think that was when you started to realize that there was more going on than just like a recounting of this Empress's exile. I guess we can discuss, like, what did you think about the overall story of this, like, Empress who is... So basically, Empress Inyo is the Empress in name only. It's a political marriage between the country that this story takes place in, which is the Empire of An, and their northern neighbor, which is, they're coded as, like, more warlike and like kind of like mixed between Vikings and Mongolians, I want to say.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
And basically the emperor sired a son, like an heir with the empress, and then like threw her away to exile in this, I guess this lake manor that becomes like her prison for a number of years, probably like almost a decade, right?
Yeah, you have to really catch on to that because it's such a short book and you expect it to be, chronological, but you're like, oh no, like a decade passed between chapters. So yeah, if you read it fast, you might miss that detail. Just a heads up.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess the Atwood parallels here is like this takes place in a very patriarchal society where the value of women is almost non-existent. And that's personified by, I mean, the emperor is the big bad, but they're kind of a pushover. What the real bad guy that you see is the minister of the left who antagonizes the empress like every chapter, pretty much. I mean, what did you think about the coup that the empress plans throughout the story and the way that that's built up? Because I know a lot of our book club members mentioned on Goodreads that the actual plot takes a while to get going. Like it takes a good almost half of the book before you start putting the pieces together that the Empress is planning a coup. The fact that Empress Inyo wins is already established from like the first few pages of this, of the novel.
Yeah. So the book is set 60 years after the events that Rabbit has told. And Chi is traveling through the Unsealed Road because the Empress you know, she had closed down all of the places she used to live in before her ascension through the throne. And I think that's like really interesting because, you know, history is written by the victors. And yeah. And there's kind of like this mythological history to Empress Inyo. And it's the history of the North and South being merged together. It's kind of, you know, a lot of the bloodiness isn't really mentioned. It's not the history that is being taught to the people of the North and South that is now merged. And it's the people who are overlooked. It's the people who, you know, weren't royalty, who didn't hold official government positions, who know the truth. And they were the ones who made the coup possible.
Yeah. It's a really interesting framing device because, so Qi is part of an order of clerics who act as, I guess, world historians. Like, they're archivists. They're in charge of gathering information and keeping it safe. And there was a really interesting passage towards, I think, the latter half of the book, or even the last third, where their bird companion says that, yeah, like, we have enough information to topple all the thrones of the world if we wanted to. And I thought that was really interesting because of what you're saying, like, the difference between, like, record and romance, right? Like, it's like, you've heard of Romance of the Three Kingdoms, right?
Oh, yeah. It's like the most famous myth in Asia. Yeah.
But so there are actually two texts of that story. There's the Romance of the Three Kingdoms and the Records of the Three Kingdoms. The Record of the Three Kingdoms is the actual, like, historical text. And the Romance is the dramatic adaptation of that text. Right? It's like the King Arthur adaptation of the historical text. So it's really interesting that this is invoking that same delineation where there's a difference between, yeah, the myth and the actual record. And the fact that, like, when you take power, it's never victimless, right? Like, throughout the story, Empress Inyo sacrifices a lot of innocent people to succeed in taking power. And you can see throughout the book that it does take a toll on her, but she has to play the part in order to win, right? In order to survive.
Yeah, I think there was a passage where Sukai, one of the fortune tellers and also Rabbit's lover, is taken away by the minister. And Rabbit says, "You could have made him stay." And Empress Inyo says, "I know, but it would have cost me something else." And Rabbit in the narration says how for Empress Inyo, the sacrifice was cheap because she would be able to get men during the pilgrimage. She would be able to get soldiers. She would be able to pass out information and also figure out how guarded certain areas were. And it all it took her was sacrificing one fortune teller. Whereas for Rabbit, it's, you know, it's her lover. It's the father of her future child. And to Rabbit, you know, that sacrifice cost her everything. It cost her, you know, like, she doesn't have a husband and she doesn't have a father for her future child. And at some point, Empress Inyo says, you know, royalty were bred to be selfish. And, you know, we're bred to see things as cost to get what we want. And I thought that was really, you know, like, I thought it was really pensive, I guess, because if you compare it to our own history, the history of every revolution, you know, the human cost isn't really talked about. It's about, you know, it's about the rulers and the generals and
yeah,
it's about the battles.
I would hesitate to call this a revolution even. I mean, I guess it's a revolution in terms of, like, overthrowing a patriarchy with a matriarchy. So I guess in that end, it's kind of revolutionary. But to me, it was still more of, like, a power struggle between monarchists, right? Monarchies. But that aside, it did, I think that scene was probably one of the more powerful ones in the book. because at this point, you know that Rabbit is basically her only friend that stuck with her throughout her entire, I guess, tenure as the Empress, right? So, like, for the reader to even get a glimpse of the turmoil that this one betrayal causes the Empress, I think it really was one of the more affecting scenes of the story. Because, I mean, you do see glimpses of this in her, like, especially when Kazu is forced to leave, but otherwise she often has this kind of aloof personality that's more like pragmatic and cold.
Yeah. You know, I didn't really catch the importance of Kazu until towards like the third act of the book, because you're like, okay, Kazu is a lady in court who's kind of lost the interest of the emperor, and she's kind of here to just keep an eye on the Empress, but, you know, she bonds with the Empress and the Rabbit, and she wants to stay, but Empress Inyo says, no, you have to go back, in a very cold and aloof way. And you don't understand, like, how important Kazu is, because what happens is that she brings the fortune tellers to Empress Inyo. And through those fortune tellers, she is able to pass codes to the north and be able to recruit soldiers. And, you know, like later on, they try to look for Kazu and she's disappeared. She was just an unpopular courtesan.
I mean, to me, the Empress being cold to her when she left was her way of deflecting any affection she has for her, because she knows that if the minister suspects that Kazu has sympathies for the Empress, like, she's done. Like, there's no way she's, like, getting out alive, right? And that was her way of at least helping her survive until she can, like, come back to her later.
Yeah, I mean, like, I still thought it was pretty amazing that such a large part of the coup came from Kazu, who was only there for, like, a brief moment. And I just thought that was, like, a really good way to set all of the set everything in motion, pretty much.
I mean, Kazu offers the Empress the means to conduct her espionage, right? So a lot of the second half of the book, or like the chapter after Kazu leaves, is where you start to realize, and that's the chapter where they talk about the star charts, right? And how the star charts are wrong. And the reason that the star charts that the Empress has is wrong is because they're not actual star charts. They're communications between her and her spies and her spy network that she builds through Kazu's connections. Like, that part was really interesting, that she was literally conducting a high-level spy network in her bedrooms, in her, like, pajamas, in her, like, house arrest prison.
I think it was even before her house arrest prison, because it was, you know, when she was still staying at the palace, she, quote-unquote, grew this obsession for fortune tellers. And I don't know if she was really obsessed with fortune tellers at that time, or if she was already planning a coup.
Because she's able to
really, like, win because the palace thinks that she's, you know,
yeah,
she's,
I mean, just a flippant girl. I think it was a long con for sure, because I mean her as a pragmatic person, I don't see her actually believing in, like, the frou-frou stuff. But I mean, she's cunning enough to know that if she hides her illicit activities behind things that are hand-waved away as girl stuff, she's able to play into the stereotypes that the patriarchy has of women, while essentially having a way to pass messages without being intercepted.
Yeah, like, even the pilgrimage that Inyo goes on to, you know, to eventually go to the capital and execute the minister, like, she's able to use the excuse of, this is a pilgrimage for women, to pray to whatever god of piety or whatnot, and she's able to use it to recruit men and come back and execute the minister.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's where you get kind of the, I mean, would that be an Atwood influence?
The thing with like blah 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 meets blah blah blah, it's just a way, it's just a marketing technique. It's just a way for the public to get kind of like the feel for the world. And I do agree that, you know, like this is a feminist tale. It's about women who are oppressed in a patriarchal society, and they use their femininity, and they use whatever means necessary to have some kind of control over their destiny. Like, I do agree with that. And having women in very low positions, but still finding ways to be important to history, that's also an Atwood theme, I guess. But aside from that, not like, it doesn't really resemble the Atwood tale. And then with like the whole Asian drama thing, yeah, like we have a lot of Asian period dramas where there's a lot of...
I mean, like, the fallen empress who comes back and conquers the empire is at least in Chinese historical drama, is a trope. There are a ton of dramas with this storyline. Maybe not with as much intrigue involved or espionage involved, but the empress who does a coup to take over the empire is something that actually has happened a lot in history as well, in Chinese history.
I really like the style of like each chapter, there were a list of objects that were in the story that Rabbit's telling at the time. And, you know, there's like these very sharp descriptions. And I really liked how these objects weren't just objects. They played a really important role in the coup. They meant something personal to the Empress and also Rabbit, even though they looked like trash. One example was the birch wood that was wrapped in black hair and iron and a feather. And it looks like trash. It's such a simple thing, but it carries so much meaning. It's a symbol of Inyo's exile and her mother's death. And it's just told in such a succinct visual way. And, you know, if that scene was, I don't know, like if that scene was filmed, I think the impact would have been the same, would have been very powerful. And it would have been like a very quick way to deliver just like the gravity of the situation. Same thing with the salt box. I thought that was a really good way to show that her brother got murdered. It was her brother, right? Because that's what I got from the following chapter when she gets really angry that one of the generals had killed her brother. So I'm guessing that the salt box was her brother's ashes.
I mean, regardless, the salt box was a way for the outside world to pass messages to her. So, I mean, even throughout the book, she was finding ways to get information and pass information along between her and her supporters.
Yeah, and things are told in, no, like I said, the objects aren't just objects. They carry a lot of meaning.
Yeah, I mean, the story is framed around Cleric Chi and their curiosity towards the, like, these hidden events of the Empress's life that has been sealed from history. And they're excited to be the first person on scene to explore. So, I mean, they're going around archiving everything they see, writing down descriptions, and then asking Rabbit about the objects. Yeah, and I agree. It's a really interesting way to show that every object has a history and has meaning to the people that were involved. It's literally like looking at museum exhibits, right? And seeing like these everyday objects and the history behind it.
Yeah, history is told. Like if you're a historian, if you're in anthropology, you're looking at objects all day. You're categorizing like where it come from, like by date, by culture. And, you know, like it's how history is told and discovered. And I really like the fact that Ni put that element in there. History isn't, you know, you have to go beyond the textbook. You have to go beyond what whatever myth is being passed around. You have to read between the lines. And the fact that these small objects that are often overlooked and seems like trash and have made like a really big impact. I really like the fact that she kind of paid tribute to modern historians and how they're able to piece together history and look beyond like what has been told. And
I mean, so what did you think about the way that the story is framed in terms of like every chapter has the same structure, right? It starts with a description of an object that she finds, them asking Rabbit about it, and then Rabbit telling a story, and then at the end, Cleric Chi reflecting on that story.
It reminded me a lot of like the elders telling their grandchildren a story, like a myth with some kind of lesson, but they leave the grandchildren to kind of figure out the lesson and the teaching. So it kind of did remind me of that a lot. As for the structure, in the beginning, I did get a little bit annoyed because it just felt like I was getting whiplash. But maybe like a quarter of the way through, I think I got used to it. And it really built up the suspense. So I did really appreciate the structure. And because Rabbit was such a close and loyal attendant to Empress Inyo, you never know if she is a reliable narrator. And I like the fact that she always asked Chi, "Do you understand?" And it's pretty much the same role that the reader is put in. The reader has to piece together all of this information. And
yeah, I think it took a couple chapters for the structure to gel as well. And I know that was a complaint that a couple of our book club members had, was that the book took a while to get going. Although in the grand scheme of things, it's a pretty short book. So relatively, it's, you know, it didn't take that long, but I wasn't impressed that the book was able to jam so much into such a short runtime. I mean, I know that there were a lot of opportunities that Nevo could have taken to really flesh out the world, but I kind of appreciate that she didn't. It's kind of like the show don't tell model in written form, which I didn't realize could be pulled off this way.
It's funny how you say show, but, you know, not tell. I feel like the book told a lot because the entire book is narration pretty much. So, yeah, a lot of things are getting told rather than shown.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? Like a lot of the,
yeah, I know
the,
what you
the
mean.
World
I know
around,
what
like
you mean.
The fact that there is magic, the fact that there are ghosts, the fact that there is like this, I feel like, the lake is some sort of magical thing too, right? Like it gives off a red glow or something. Like there's a lot of fantastical elements in this book that I think a full-on fantasy novel would have spent a chapter describing the history of that. But in this book, you get like a line at most. Like sometimes you even get like a phrase, right? Like you get a phrase saying, oh yeah, there's a dude who cast magic to make every day summer for 60 years.
Yeah. Like you said, if it was a traditional fantasy novel, they would have dove deeper into it. And the book would have been much longer because fantasy novels, they have the tendency to be like 300 pages plus because they just have to set up a lot of the world building and a lot of the rules. But because this book is being told through the eyes of a handmaiden, who's kind of from like a very simple background, you didn't really need all of that information. Personally, as someone who, you know, is used to a lot of longer fantasy novels and really appreciates a lot of the minute details of how things work, I kind of wish that I did get more of the culture and the religion and how the magic worked. But I'm pretty content with the way Nee wrote it. I understand why they wrote it that way. And also, I'm kind of comforted with the fact that there is a sequel and it comes out in December. So I will get more details and maybe that'll satisfy like my curiosity for a lot of the world building and the magical elements.
It's a standalone sequel, though. It's not a continuation.
Yeah, but it's still set in the same world. So I think, I don't know, like for the themes of the book, for considering like who is the narrator, I think the sparse details did fit the novel. I think it's really up to personal preferences. And as for people who said that it was a slow start and just a lot of things happening towards the end, it mimics history because there are going to be decades where, you know, nothing happens. And then once the revolution happens, things can happen within weeks. Empires can be toppled within weeks of violence or a coup.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that not a lot happens in the beginning, but I think on the second reading, you start to see that she's been putting the pieces in place from the get-go, right? You mentioned that she started planting seeds, that she's into fortune-telling. I think it does play on the fact that, like, even at first, the readers are also misled into thinking that the Empress may be, like, a frivolous, cold person. Where, if you look at it, knowing what the plan is, like, she's been cunning from the start.
Actually, so, like, the ending, this is probably the biggest spoiler in the book. You find out that the current Empress, the Empress that is about to be crowned, the daughter of the Empress of Salt and Fortune, is actually not the daughter of Inyo. She's the daughter of Rabbit. And I kind of figured out that twist as soon as Rabbit got pregnant. I don't know about you, Marvin, because in my head, I was thinking, Inyo gets surgery so that she is unable to give birth to any more children. And it's just like, how did she get a daughter then? Like, the daughter would have to be adopted or, you know, like, I don't know. But I was just like, okay, Rabbit is pregnant.
It could have been like elected monarchy. It could have been like someone.
I know. Yeah. I was thinking about like how that happened as soon as the writer said Inyo is unable to have future children. I was trying to piece together that. And as soon as Rabbit got pregnant, I was like, oh, okay, so that's the big secret. That's the big reveal.
I mean, also in that chapter, it ends with like a wham line that pretty much confirms it, right? Rabbit describes the new Empress as someone who can take on wolves because she was raised by an angry mother, which is something that I think Fong told her about her own daughter.
No, it was told from Mai, one of the fortune tellers. Mai was the one who, you know, who realized that Rabbit was pregnant, and Rabbit finds out that she's pregnant through Mai, and Mai comforts her by saying, angry mothers raise daughters fierce enough to fight wolves.
And I mean, it's not exactly subtle, and I don't think it's meant to be, but I think that's when I realized. So I was probably a little bit slower on the uptake, because at that point I was still wondering if whether or not she was going to keep the baby.
Yeah. I think a lot of people realize that the Empress, the current Empress, is Rabbit's daughter when Inyo tells Rabbit, I have taken everything from you. It is the nature of royalty, I am afraid, what we are bred for and what we are taught. I will not take more unless you tell me it's all right. Do you understand? And at this point, Rabbit only has her child. Like, her child is the only thing that is precious in her life. And the Empress is telling her, is it okay for me to take your child? This is, you know, this is your decision. I will not take her unless you tell me it's okay. And I think it's a very obvious sign of what's to come, what the twist is.
Yeah, at that point, I was still thinking, oh, is she telling her to, like, get rid of the baby? That was where my head was at. But I did think it was kind of brilliant that the Empress used Rabbit's baby as like proof of her divine mandate to rule. You know, like, look at this. I have an immaculate conception baby.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that happens a lot in pretty much like every country's history. There's going to be like some supernatural element to it. There's going to be exaggeration to make the leaders look great. So I wasn't surprised by that myth, by people saying like, oh, she's so powerful that she was able to have a child, even though like she got surgery to make her infertile. So,
I mean, I guess overall, how did you feel? This is our first novella for the book club. How did you feel
Doesn't Convenience Store Woman count as a novella?
Is that a novella? I guess that was also
it's like a short novel. It's like the in-between a novella and a short novel, I think.
I mean, that one took, I think that one was a little bit longer though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a little bit longer, but I don't know. This is probably the first official novella, because this is what it was being marketed as.
Yeah. I mean, what did you think about reading something that's shorter?
Because it was shorter, I don't know. I was really surprised by how many events happened in such a short span of reading time. I also bought the audiobook when I was reading this, and the audiobook was only 2 hours long. And I was just really surprised by the... I prejudged the book. I was like, okay, this is a short novel. Like, I'm pretty sure like it's there's not a lot of time to do the world building. Like, I'm curious as to like how much political intrigue is going to be in this book, and it turns out that there's a lot. And I was pleasantly surprised, and I'm pretty sure that. I don't know if other fantasy novellas do the same thing, where they have to like streamline all of the magical elements.
Yeah, I also really enjoyed how dense it was, despite the fact that it was only, like you said, 112 pages. So another thing that our members on Goodreads mentioned was the fact that it ends kind of abruptly, in their opinion. Given that this is our first official novella, how did you think the book did in terms of telling a complete story?
It is a complete story. It definitely has... Like, I think the ending was... Like, the ending was okay. Did it make me want more? Yes. I wish there was about, like, 50 pages more. But then again, would be venturing into the short novel territory. But I think where it ended, where, you know, Rabbit turns out to be... Was Rabbit a ghost at the end? I wasn't sure. Like, it was like she was waiting.
I think that might have been the implication, that she was telling the story to Clerk Chi was like her last act before she moves on. Because,
yeah, whether she was a ghost or not, it doesn't matter. It was, yeah. The whole point was Rabbit was waiting to tell the secrets and history to someone who would make sure that it gets passed on.
Yeah, and I think because Rabbit represents like the forgotten people that make history happen, right? She was, you know, Empress Inyo's like confidant and support throughout her entire like political, like throughout her entire coup. She was a pawn, but also a like one of her only friends. And she represents all of the...
The overlooked, the silenced, the nameless, the insignificant people that turns out to play a much bigger role in the game of
I wouldn't
political
say insignificant.
Chess.
Yeah, I would say like kind of, yeah, her and her story represents all of the people that history tends to forget, right? Like, I think there's the chapter where she mentions like Sukai and his contributions to the cause. And you can see how relieved she is when Cleric Chi promises to remember and document Sukai's existence in the archives. going back to the topic of the story feeling complete, I think I get the frustration that people want to know like more details about the actual coup. You know, you spend this whole time building up this this power move, and then it gets resolved in a couple pages. But I don't think that was the point of the story in and of itself, right?
I think the reason why it seems more like an incomplete ending is because if this was a movie, if this was a series, you're pretty much ending the story on the first act. Because it's like a story about a new empire, and you end it with the ascension of the Empress. So I can see why you would want more. And also, like you said, so much of the coup happens late in the book, and you want to know more details. And even though that doesn't fit with the theme that Nevo wants for this book, like, I can't blame readers for wanting more. I mean, I'm one of the readers who wish there was more details on it.
I mean, at the same time, it's not actually the Empress's story, right? It's Rabbit's story and Rabbit's closure. And I think that's why the last chapter involves like a dream of Rabbit moving on, because this is not the story of how Empress Inyil took back her empire. This is a story about how her trusty, you know, handmaiden supported her the entire way, and what she sacrificed to help her master fulfill their dreams. And I think that's why the story ends with that dream sequence of Rabbit finally catching up to Sukai in like what I assume is the afterlife, because in the end, this was her story.
Yeah, yeah. But like we said earlier, there is a sequel. It's standalone, and it's set in the same world. So, you know,
like, yeah, it's still a story about Cleric Chi and their, you know, travels. But I don't think it has anything to do with the Empress or the new Empress.
Yeah, same here. I'm probably going to read the sequel or the companion piece just because I want more. And I will take what I can get. I do really like Chi as a character. I really like the role that they played as a historian cleric. I think it's because I watched the Castlevania animated series on Netflix, and there's a character who is pretty much like who pretty much is a cleric that whose job is to record history. And pass on information to the public through the generations. So I'm glad that she is the main character in the sequel, that we get to see more of them.
Yeah. So that the second book is coming out later this year, right? It's not out yet?
It's coming out in December.
I'll probably check it out too. I mean, I think it's a little bit longer than this book, but it's still a novella. And I was able to read this book in about a day.
Yeah, I read this book twice within 4 hours with the audiobook. So yeah, like I'm down to read one more story by Nevo.
Yeah. Any final thoughts about the book?
I like the fact that it was a quiet fantasy, that it was told from a commoner's point of view. I like the themes. I like the fact that it was a feminist story. And I think Nevo did a really good job building the world in such a short amount of time. Yes, I wish there were more details and I wish I got more, but I think the story is complete overall. How about you, Marvin?
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. I Asian-inspired fantasy is something that I am super into. I'm into all things genre, especially if they're Asian-inspired. I didn't have as much a problem about the sparse details. I actually enjoyed the fact that they mentioned fantastical things without really explaining them and allowing the reader to kind of fill in the blanks themselves. It was a really fun, quick story about an empress who wouldn't take no for an answer and ended up sticking it to the man. It was really satisfying to see the minister of the left get what was coming to him. And I think I'm interested to see what else this world can offer. But again, I was really impressed by how much Neville was able to squeeze into 112 pages. I think that was really impressive. Yeah. And as always, if any of you listening have any thoughts of your own about The Empress of Salt and Fortune, please let us know on our Goodreads forums. There is an ongoing thread there discussing the book, and we'd love to hear your opinions. But
yeah, even if they're disagreeing opinions.
But with that, that'll do it for our discussion of The Empress of Salt and Fortune by Nivo. Rira, what are we reading for the month of September?
We are reading Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning by Kathy Park Hong. So this book is nonfiction. It's a collection of essays by Kathy, who kind of blends memoir writing with just an exploration on race, on privilege within the Asian American community. And I know that there are serious topics like anti-blackness and just kind of like the history of how Asian Americans have grown within this country and kind of the trauma that we feel as we grow up with kind of the trauma that we feel with each generation, from what I understand. I've really wanted to read this book since Alexander Chi recommended it on Twitter. So I'm really excited to dive into it. It's been a while since we've ventured into nonfiction. Nonfiction isn't really a genre that we dive into often. So I'm really glad that we are giving it another whirl this time around.
Yeah. I've actually been meaning to pick up this book as well. So I'm glad that I'm now forced to read it. For our book club.
Some people already read it. Some people have already commented in our Goodreads forums about reading it already. So,
Yeah. Yeah. And with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Bulba. Thank you so much for listening, Rira. Thank you again for 3 amazing years as the co-host of this book club podcast.
Thank you for being the producer and forcing me to be on this podcast. For those of you who haven't listened to our first episode, the reason why the catalyst for us to start this podcast was I went to a mixer and someone mentioned there aren't any Asian American authors outside of like Amy Tan or whatever. And I said, what are you talking about? There are so many modern contemporary Asian American authors. And I got angry and I said on Facebook, I want to make a book club. And Marvin saw that post and said, hey, let's start a podcast. And I said, yes, without even thinking about it. And once I thought about it, I said, oh no, what have I agreed to? And now here we are 3 years later.
Yeah.
So thank you, Marvin, for taking the initiative.
No problem. I'm glad to. I've always wanted an excuse to read more books, and now I have it. So it's win-win for everybody. But thank you all so much for listening to Books and Bulba. Thank you for all of you who have stuck with us for the past 3 years. Here's to another year of Books and Bulba. Thanks for listening, and we'll see y'all later. Bye, everyone.
All right, bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Bulba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandbulba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandbulba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Books and Bulba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Brian, did you go to Saturday school as a kid?
I sure did. Did you?
Totally.
Well, at our podcast, Saturday School, we don't teach a language, but we pass along the culture that we do know.
And that's Asian American pop culture.
Ada's a journalist, and I'm a professor and film festival programmer.
We've watched a lot of great Asian American movies, and we want you to watch them too. Come listen to us as we look back at the pioneering films that have led us to today.